Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you.
His Royal Highness the Emir Faisal, representing and acting on behalf of the Arab Kingdom of Hejaz, and Dr. Chaim Weissman, representing and acting on behalf of the Zionist organization, mindful of the racial kinship and ancient bonds existing between the Arabs and the Jewish people, and realizing that the surest means of working out the consummation of their national aspirations is through the closest possible collaboration in the development of the Arab state and Palestine, and being desirous further of confirming the good understanding which exists between them, have agreed upon the following articles. Faisal Weissman Agreement, January 3, 1919.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone, and I'd like to thank you all for joining me on this very special episode of the Turning Tides podcast. Today, we are joined by Miles Spencer. He is the co-author of the best-selling book, A Line in the Sand, which tells the story of two best friends who travel through space and time to uncover the hidden mysteries about T.E. Lawrence, his Middle East campaign in World War I, and the origins of the conflicts throughout the Middle East today. First of all, Miles, how are you today? And would you like a minute to tell us a little bit more about yourself and your book?
Sure, Joseph. I'm doing just fine, thank you. Greenwich, Connecticut today, and it is cold as heck. We had some actual snow first time for the winter, so all good. Looks pretty. Probably different than Vegas. By way of background, I guess I'm just a curious guy from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that wandered a long way from home. My early years were spent there, I guess perhaps a Midwestern sensibility and work ethic, if that actually exists. Went to the East Coast for schooling and developed quite an interest in history because of a few very influential teachers. I'll tell you more about that later. I'm a tech entrepreneur and investor. I've had the good fortune of growing and exiting three businesses, about 1,000 employees, and I might add 30 others that utterly failed, which helped me build the three that actually succeeded. I'm a dad of two nutty kids, and I also like to paint and swim and do wild adventures with my friends, but we'll talk more about that later, I'm sure. So that's about me in a nutshell. I like Sounds Dijon good. Mustard.
Dijon mustard, yeah. Classy, elite flavoring. So the first thing anyone notices when they read your book, which is fantastic, by the way, is your immense wealth of historical knowledge. And you mentioned we were going to talk about this. What was the catalyst that sort of started this whole interest in history?
Well, first of all, I'm not a historian. I just love history. And I love to use stories to teach people about history that I think would be important to a culture, to a region, to an understanding. And so with that out of the way, when I got to boarding school in my teenage years, there were a few professors, the one that comes to mind is G. Edmondson Maddox. Now, once again, it's important to be a great storyteller, perhaps when you're teaching history to sleepy boys in the afternoon in Connecticut. So anyways, Mr. Maddox, as we would call him, walked into my Roman history class because my Roman history teacher had to take a phone call or something. And he said, let me tell you about Roman history. I was born in Rome, Georgia. And he went on for 5 minutes until the actual teacher walked back in. But we were absolutely captivated by his ability to tell a story. And in the end, I said, boy, I'd like to read more about it. I ended up with a couple of specific periods I was really interested in. One was the period of the Crusades. The second was the French Revolution. And then the period between the First and Second World War. My father also had those interests, and my grandfather fought in one of those wars. Several of my uncles fought in the world wars of the 20th century. And so it was always kind of around us, not as students or educators or scholars, but just that general curiosity and knowledge. That's my history chops.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think that's how a lot of people approach it. There's that, I think it's Cicero who said it. He says, anyone who doesn't understand what happened before they were born is forever doomed to be a child. And that's one of the reasons I study history is that I just don't want to feel like an infant when confronted with these major world obstacles. I don't want to just be blindsided by it. I want to have some recollection of it and be able to explain it to my parents. And sometimes they call me and they'll be like, Joe, can you please explain this to us? We don't really understand it. And I'm like, okay, let's strap in, guys. It's 800 years ago. Anyways. So you brought up your upbringing in Pittsburgh, PA, which is a history-rich city. Did this have, I mean, obviously this had an effect on your worldview today and your outlook on history?
You know, I'd love to say that was true, but the history that I learned in Pittsburgh at the time I was growing up was that of the Steelers and the Pirates. And that was about it. I later learned that, look, it was the where U.S. Steel was created. It was where great amount of wealth was created. Some great art collectors, which I later became interested in, whether that was Frick or Carnegie. That the fact that I was seeing most of that artwork in New York City, but the wealth that created it and the wealth that was created that allowed them to purchase it was created in Pittsburgh, was all kind of very interesting to me. And I go back on a regular basis and I go see those places, and they have such a different meaning now than they did when I was a kid. But to be honest, I was an okay history student for sure. I was an okay student for sure when I was in Pittsburgh, but it was about football and to a certain extent baseball with the Pirates.
Fair enough. It's a huge thing in I guess anywhere in PA. I only have the recollection of Philadelphia, but there it was football crazy, and I assume it's very similar in Pittsburgh. You guys want to one up, you got to one up Philly all the time.
We try, although look, we have no constitutional history in Pittsburgh the way Philadelphia does.
Yeah,
whether it's the Liberty Bell, drafting the Constitution, Ben Franklin, or you name, we just don't have that in Pittsburgh. So props to Philadelphia in that regard.
You got to give it where it's due. I mean, they just won the Super Bowl. We got to give it where it's due. So you start your book during the famous, and some would say infamous, running of the bulls in Pamplona, Spain. What is the significance of the running of the bulls, and why start your time traveling Middle Eastern epic there?
Well, every book has to start somewhere, I guess. I mean, Indiana Jones and starts things in Hong Kong and ends up in Peru. So in that regard, look, our first draft of the book mentioned offhandedly that the two characters had met in Pamplona. And one of the gentlemen that helps us pull together the early drafts, name is Alex. He's just like, you know, in the liner notes, might want to tell me a little bit more about this one. And indeed, Wells and I had recently run in Pamplona ourselves, which is typical of many of the things that are in the book. And so we had a very immersive adventure in Pamplona. And suddenly it just clicked. What better way to quickly get people's attention and give a sense of these two men, Magnus and Finn, and their appetite for adventures with purpose and journeys of understanding than to go run with six 2,000-pound beasts through the winding streets of Pamplona. So it was fresh in our mind. It worked. And there you have it. That's not all that much to do with the Middle East, but neither does, you know, Oxford or London or Paris, until you dig underneath and you realize that a lot of those places have a lot to do with colonial lands far, far away.
Definitely, definitely true. And just a follow-up question real quick. Were you actually gored by a bull in Spain?
I was not gored by a bull in Spain, but the dehiscence, which is referred to in that book, is actually an injury I have sustained. That was 260 stitches for me. And I have the scar there and other places to prove it. So no, Wells and I did run from Ayuntamiento, which is the first turn, through Mercaderes to Dead Man's Turn, where I cut behind the bulls. But they did not catch their horn on me. And I did witness some unfortunates in front of us on the long stretch, which is basically the safer stretch. And I did get into the ring at the end. So everything but the injury on that day, I experienced the injury on a different day.
And you sort of answered this question already, but just to confirm it, one can't help but notice when they look into information on you and Mr. Wells, that there are certain similarities between you two and the two characters in your books. How similar are you two, and how do you diverge?
Extremely is the way I would answer. First of all, this is all based on a true story, right? As they say. And so when I look at the differences of our real characters in Magnus and Finn, I mean, the first glaring error, spoiler alert, is we do not actually have in our possession a time-traveling device that has been proven to work. However, we're working on it. Did not have any rockets fired at a Dassault Falcon jet that we were in over Lebanon. Besides that, there are precious few things in the book that we did not experience ourselves.
That's pretty impressive. Wow. So what first got you interested in the Middle East, and with T.E. Lawrence especially?
Well, Joseph, it really started with 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to get my head around it. Who, what, where I went. Remember, curious guy from Pennsylvania, right? And I just had no good answers. I was reading and reading and reading. No good answers. No complete answers. No answers that I was willing to just accept some understanding. Most of the answers were tilted in a way. Remember, shock and response, right? So, well, that's convenient. And thank God Wells was traveling through Connecticut at the time. And he said, what are you reading? I said, T.E. Lawrence, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. So am I. What did you think? And he and I both concluded that this was really the one man from the West that had understood the Bedouin culture and was able to translate and share that with the West to any degree. And I found out later that an awful lot of army personnel stationed on the ground in the Middle East had this book in their backpack. So Wells and I looked at each other and said, well, you know, what else do we need to do in order to understand? And the answer was, let's go. And so we did.
And you got, you know, boots on the ground, you two in this case, and you literally got to understand the culture and the people and all this, which you detail in your book. And you even detail like recipes and stuff, which I actually made the Baba Ganoush recipe in your book. It's really amazing. Highly recommend it.
I'm an amateur chef, I guess. And we were, among many things that blew us away there, was the cooking, food. And I said, well, we've got to put recipes in the book. People really understand. And so we did. And so I love the fact that people are touched by that, try that, enjoy that. But that was one very important immersive detail that we wanted to include.
And what's a better way to understand someone's culture than to try their cuisine and to try what they eat? You know, that it's one of the surest fire ways to sit down with someone from that culture who's made that food and enjoy it with them. I mean, that's really beautiful, and that shows a real transcendence that the human animal possesses.
Well, a little extra about the food. We also concluded later, especially in the Middle East, that every time we were negotiating something, every time we needed to get an answer, there was always something cooking on the brazier in the background. And we were never able to get a bite of anything until we concluded with the negotiation. I think it was a negotiation tactic.
It's very clever.
My low blood sugar played right into it. So I tried to bring that out in the book as well.
Nice. Nice. It definitely comes through all the stuff about the food. It's really great. So one of the more powerful moments in your book is when the two protagonists are sitting with an old Jewish woman, Beba, and you're discussing the 9/11 attacks. Character Magnus says, quote, "This wasn't an attack. It was a counterattack, an act of retribution," unquote. So this line exemplifies an incredibly nuanced grasp of history. Would you be able to give a truncated list of some of the initial attacks against the Middle East by Western powers?
Sure. And of course, it's all a matter of perspective, but I would go back to what we call the initial jihad, which was the very fact that it was the Pope that declared the Crusades to be something not only spiritual and religious, but something that would be a way for pilgrims to make it to Jerusalem. Yet any one that they killed on their way, specifically first Jews and then Arabs, they would be absolved of any guilt beforehand. I mean, to me, that's a holy war. Mm. And the Crusaders certainly did prosecute it well. And so how far do you want to go back? that's 1,000 years. If we go back a little less, perhaps, maybe just a few decades, there was a time in which during Desert Storm, one and two, the United States was defending Kuwait and ostensibly Saudi Arabia from Saddam Hussein. Now, Iraq and Kuwait were at dispute over some shared oil resources when Saddam rolled in. So behind that was Saudi, and not just Saudi, but Aramco. And so America put many, many, many boots on the ground, ostensibly to defend those resources. In that process, what they actually did was offend one man. And let me tell you how that story played out, because it's not in the book, but from what we understand. Look, originally Osama bin Laden, who was a descendant of a very, very wealthy Saudi family based in construction. They built Mecca, by the way. He had gone abroad, actually fought in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen, and became very good at warfare, specifically guerrilla warfare. And so at that moment in which Saddam was threatening, he came back to the kingdom and said, look, I can raise an army. I can defend Saudi Arabia. What better than to have a Saudi Arabian do it rather than these Americans? Well, the Sauds have controlled the peninsula for 100 years for a variety of reasons, one of which is they're smart. And they did not want to create a hero with an army on the Saudi peninsula. So I wouldn't say that this was necessarily an attack by the Americans. It was really defending the resources of their own and Saudis. But it was a psychological attack on Osama. I guess his feelings were hurt. And that's part of what drove him to persecute the attack on 9/11. He was left out. And he felt slighted. And that was his response.
And he felt slighted by the whole Western world. It wasn't specifically the United States. It was basically the entire hegemonic rule of, you know, European colonialism. This was what he was really striking out against. It wasn't necessarily American blue jeans.
No, for sure. You are correct. But I think the catalyst was not getting picked for the role of defending Saudi Arabia during Desert Storm.
Most definitely.
For good reason.
Yeah. We just talked about it a little bit, the Crusades in the 1100s to the 1300s. So besides defining those centuries of history and causing geopolitical havoc in the region, what are some other lasting effects that the Crusades have had on the Maghreb and the Middle East in general?
Very good croissants in Damascus. Look, in the long term, you know, in the 1,000 years since the Crusades, those castles still exist. Prax Chevalier, Karak Castle, Karak and Mohabist. These are fantastic fortresses, which were actually created by the Knights Templar in a basically a pit stop system. It was very interesting as we were doing our research. You have these nobles in Europe that have been convinced that getting to Jerusalem would be a life's high point. And so they gave their land to the Knights Templar in exchange for room and board all the way to Jerusalem in the form of these castles. So to a certain extent, the prepaid credit card system was developed at that time by the Crusades. The castles are certainly there. The French language is certainly there. The croissants are certainly there. But what comes to mind when you make that comment is, once again, during the lead up to Desert Storm, I believe it was Desert Storm. Do you remember Shock and Awe and that campaign where there were weapons of mass destruction somewhere in the world?
Mm-hmm.
And on the U.S. representation at the United Nations was Colin Powell. Some photographs of this, that. And on the other side was Jacques Chirac, who was either prime minister at the time, president. He was originally mayor of Paris, but I think he was probably prime minister or foreign secretary. And he said, look, Americans, yeah, very nice, but you don't know this corner of the world. We've been here 1,000 years. We know the people. We know the customs. We know how things work. So to a certain extent, he was saying, slow down. Now, the ultimate irony of that is that during the period covered by our book, France actually never set foot never set boots in the Levant. They were busy defending against the Germans in Europe, yet they were able to claim their fair share of Lebanon and Syria post-World War I because, number one, they'd been there for so long, 1,000 years, and number two, they had fought so hard in Europe, and if they didn't, then perhaps the other countries, Great Britain, would be sunk. So there was definitely some irony in the fact that Jacques Chirac was claiming that France had been there for a long time, which is true. It's just intermittently, he might have said.
Yeah, definitely. So besides the bitter millennial-old conflict between the Christians and Muslims, which we've been talking about, there is a more confined conflict within the Muslim community itself. Besides just religious differences between Shia and Sunni, there are political, cultural, and tribal differences which often lead to sectarian violence of some form or another. This obviously played a huge role in the creation of the modern-day Maghreb in the Middle East. In what ways did the Allied powers, France and Great Britain, ignore these disputes for their own gain?
Well, first of all, to your comment about the age-old Christian and Islam conflict, my experience has been that even though there have been military incursions back and forth, there's very little conflict between the people, and the amount of time that we spent with the people was one of commonality and amicable coexistence. So I acknowledge the fact that there are wars, but I would say that perhaps it wasn't the majority of the people that were interested in that.
Having said
that, did the powers that be ignore the sectarian conflict? Well, of course they do. I mean, I think they knew it existed. The very fact that Lawrence, Gertrude Bell, Percy Cox, and the rest were a bit of a sideshow at the Paris Peace Conference. The people that understood the tribes and their dynamics and the geography and its dynamics were not the one drafting the agreements post-World War I. Right?
Yeah.
They attempted to influence it, gave it a heck of a shot, but in reality, it was sort of shut out at the Majestic Hotel, frankly, during the Paris Peace Conference. And so my take on it is whether or not the powers that be considered it, ignored it, acknowledged it, this is about land and resources. And I believe that that peace conference, as it applies to the Middle East, was all about land and resources. Remember, you got the Suez Canal, which at the time was probably the most valuable piece of land in the region, piece of water in the region, because of what it meant to trade. Oil was not quite a known fact. Winston Churchill, as vice chairman of the Admiralty, if I have that title correct, had begun a program to switch the Royal Navy from coal, which is not available all over the world, to oil, which is a little more so. And their early deals were with, basically, it was with Persia, right? And that's where they thought that they were going to extract the most resources from the region. Turns out they picked well, but they didn't pick perfectly well. The Americans ended up with the best relationship with the Saudis, who had most of the resources. So while I think the powers that be at the time, Paris Peace Conference, the combination of Wilson, Clemenceau, and Lloyd George, probably knew that those tribal frictions existed, but subordinated that in their decisions to higher priorities. And it came back to bite them.
Most assuredly. And so, as we're finishing up for today, besides T.E. Lawrence, if you could have a drink with any historical figure, living or dead, who would it be and why?
Right. So I thought about this a bit. Sad I can only pick one.
But you can pick a grouping if you'd like.
Perhaps. You know, the first one for sure would be Bonaparte, because you know, not because he was such a nice guy, not because he was responsible for the deaths of millions of Europeans, including his own countrymen, but he was so innovative. He was almost an Italian. Had he been born 2 weeks earlier in Corsica, he would have been Italian. He turned out to be French. Ended up going to the École Militaire because of that. And learned his trade, which was shooting cannons because of that. I don't know where he got his talent for shooting cannons at his own people, which were part of the revolution. But he was also, you know, interestingly enough, he understood, which Lawrence understood as well, he who writes the dispatches controls the news. So when he was getting back from the very unsuccessful campaign in Egypt, he was sending dispatches in on how well he had done. So when he arrived in Paris during the height of the revolution, they were looking for a hero and he fit the bill. And so I would say, there's some other leaders around that are probably pretty good at that lately. He also was quite a inventor, from what I understand. Sardines in a can, as we know them now, may well have originated from an idea that Napoleon had about preserving protein for preserving fish. So there are many. He is one. And it'd probably be a pretty good dinner.
Oh, yeah. It would be very, very heavy. You need like an Alka-Seltzer after that, I feel like. A lot of heavy sauce and French wine. And
yes, that's for sure.
So what's next for you? And will there be a sequel to A Line in the Sand? Or a prequel.
There is. There is. It is already done.
Oh, my.
It is probably due for publication in 2 months. It's called Havana Familia, and it is set in Cuba, which is another colonial object of desire, which both the Spanish and the Americans and the Russians and the mob all wanted to get their hands on. And so Magnus and Finn are back. There are no scenes at Pamplona, but it opens just as exciting. And we have a rip-roaring time in 2016, which was the momentary thaw and the moment of great hope in Havana. And then New Year's Eve 1958, which was peak Havana fun times.
That's a very interesting idea for a book. I'm very excited to read that.
It will we'll continue the fun. I think Magnus and Finn are probably good for 3, 4, 5 books
in
the world with similar circumstances.
Very interesting. So finally, where can people get in touch with you? Where can people find your work? Where can people get this book?
Sure. Twitter X, Miles Spencer, and Instagram, Miles to Go. My LinkedIn's not bad if you want to do some business. My website, where I kind of consolidate all these crazy ideas, is milesspencer.com. But of course, the book is on Amazon. The Audible is also available. And frankly, it's the same words, but it's narrated by a wonderful narrator named Eduardo Ballerini. And I listened to it, and I said, wow, that's the same words, but sounds so much better, especially the Pamplona bull run. So I highly encourage that. That's a line in the sand under Spencer and Jones in Amazon, Kindle, paperback, or Audible.
And I highly encourage it to anyone who's interested in history, anyone who's interested in time travel or sci-fi, or anything like this, you should pick up this book and you should read it.
Well, thank you very much.
No problem. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Hi, everyone. Joseph Pescone here. I just wanted to take another quick moment to say thank you to Miles Spencer for being on the show. And thank you all so much for tuning in. Next week, Miles's co-author, Wells Jones, is going to be on the podcast to give his 2 cents on the very complicated region, which is the Middle East, in order that we can better understand what's going on there from people who have literally been there. Thank you so much again. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.